Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased today to be talking with my friend Emily Warner, Assistant Professor of American Art here at Vassar College, who is here to talk with us about the exhibit she has in the art library. The title of that exhibit is Surveys and Souvenirs, American World's Fairs, 1876 to 1939, on view through May 29th in the art library in the reading room. This is an exhibit of World's Fair surveys, guidebooks, photographs, poster stamps, and other memorabilia in Vassar Collections. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It is great to be here, and we're here in your office.
We are, with a poster from the fair behind us.
So can you tell us how this exhibit came about? You had a class?
Yeah, that's right. So it began with a seminar that I taught this past fall on American World's Fairs. And as part of that seminar, we visited special collections at the library here at Vassar. And I hadn't realized at first what a wealth of material they had here, but it was really impressive. So sort of at that point, as we were going through the various guidebooks and pamphlets and photography books, it seemed like it was something that could really be worth having on display for a wider group of people to see. And it also gave the students in the class a chance to think about the sort of question of what remains in the archives of these fairs. One of the questions we asked in that seminar was whose viewpoint is represented at the fairs.
Oh, that's interesting, because not everything would be collected.
Right, exactly. And so then that turns this kind of theoretical question about whose viewpoint into a very kind of real and practical question about what's there, what do you find in the archives?
Yeah, interesting. And I expect having students work on an exhibit like this, you're able to do research on individual items that if you were a curator, you wouldn't have time to devote yourself if you were just doing the whole thing yourself. Is that the case? Yes, absolutely.
And the students also played a really crucial role in shaping the direction of what we put on display. So we spent a couple of hours in one of our sessions in Special Collections, and we brought out a bunch of stuff. I mean, we could probably fill another case if we wanted to with objects. And at that point, the students went around choosing what they thought were the most important objects to have on display. Another thing that was really important that came out of that is after we had our initial list, we asked ourselves, what's missing from this? You know, are there stories that we're not telling that have come up in the class? And a big one was this question of ethnography and the depiction of other cultures and other races. And so being able to identify that gap with the students is part of what led to getting some loans to fill in that gap.
Interesting questions. Those would be, I would expect.
You know,
because you have people depicted, you have racial types and ethnic types being depicted, but you also have racially diverse people coming to the fair to see these things.
Yeah, that's true. Or not coming to the fair.
Or not.
I mean, and it's a bit of a mix. I mean, it's interesting to that first point. It was very much a lot of these fairs, they were kind of staging grounds for ideas about a hierarchy of civilizations or a hierarchy of races. And that often took form through displays and exhibitions on the midways, the amusement sections of these fairs. And a lot of these, we can understand them within the context of colonialism and imperialism at the time. Interestingly, you also have really important figures within the early history of American ethnography and anthropology trying to organize more what they called scientific displays of peoples and cultures. So there's this tension between a more popular Wild West version of cultural difference and then one that tries to be more kind of scientifically valid. But both of them are very tied up in these racialized ideas about progress.
It's sort of instruction and entertainment.
That's right, and I think even beyond the question of ethnicity and race, that's a major structuring tension at the fairs, is education and entertainment. How do you bring those two things together?
Interesting. You know, we're talking about what's left in the archive, but in a sense, these fairs are archives in and of themselves. The whole thing is a kind of museological endeavor, isn't it? You have real objects. We're working with real objects, you know, real people even. But you're trying to classify everything and make sense of it, in a sense, aren't you? And it is universal. It's encyclopedic, in a way.
Absolutely. And I think that really comes across in the late 19th century fairs. And I should say, as you noted in your intro, this exhibition covers fairs from 1876 up to 1939. But those fairs in 1876 and through about 1901 or 1904 or so, they're really devoted to amassing information uh-huh. and finding the most persuasive and effective way to put it on display. Uh-huh. There's one object that we have, the Illustrated History of the Centennial Exhibition, which has a number of beautiful foldouts, engravings mm-hmm. of the 1876 fair in Philadelphia. And the one that we have on view shows a few figures looking out from a kind of viewing platform mm-hmm. out into this large hall, which was the main exhibit hall. Mm-hmm. And the amount of goods, the kind of density of objects that have been stuffed into this hall is really apparent there, right? I mean, these were very much epistemological projects. Uh-huh. They were very much about gathering as much information, as much stuff as possible, and yeah. then finding a way to organize it.
Yeah, interesting. What this reminds me of a bit is what I know about the Crystal Palace, which was also packed with absolutely everything.
Absolutely.
From manufacturers as well as ethnic and national displays. So we started 1876, but the fairs actually go back before then, don't
That's
they?
Right.
Go back. Well, Crystal Palace is sometimes thought of as the first World's Fair, but there were fairs before that.
Yeah, so the 1851 is really crucial as this kind of first, we could say, modern World's Fair.
Yeah.
Now, the World's Fair itself, even the Crystal Palace, is building on other kinds of trade fairs,
yeah.
other kinds of sort of gatherings where you're putting things on display.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Crystal Palace in London really is the first one that tries to be universal in uh-huh. terms of an international competition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's called the Fair of All Nations.
Uh-huh.
The idea
yeah.
is that they're bringing together there all of these different European nations, and they're going to sort of compete with one another,
yeah,
right? That's
uh-huh,
the idea
yeah.
in something like the Crystal Palace, is
yeah.
you can move from one national display to the
yeah,
next
yeah.
And sort of see, obviously, since England is the host nation,
yeah.
they're hoping that they will come out as particularly impressive
yeah.
and particularly able with industrial
yeah.
displays.
Interesting. And it's a celebration of European colonialism, isn't it? I mean, everybody's showing that their colonies have all these goods and all these advantages.
That's so, right. Yeah. And that becomes increasingly emphatic in the coming decades.
Yeah.
And you see
yeah.
that in the American fairs, too, interestingly,
yeah.
even
uh-huh.
before the U.S. has an overseas empire. So even at 1893, for example,
yeah.
you have several displays of peoples who are colonial subjects of
yeah.
one kind or another.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after the Spanish-American War, when the U.S. does have an overseas empire,
yeah.
that becomes a major part of the display.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Interesting.
And I should say, too, before that, right, before the U.S. has an overseas empire, it is still actively expanding westward, right, in 1876, and
yeah.
then 1893 kind
yeah.
of marks the end of that,
yeah.
but certainly at those 19th century fairs, the
yeah.
U.S. does have portrayals of Native Americans as a kind of what they are presenting as an inferior civilization.
Yeah.
Right?
So this is a critical time in U.S. history, isn't it? It's when we are becoming a colonizing power in a way, and the exhibitions that we have on display, they run from 1876 to the Second World War, so
that's
it's
right.
really kind of critical period.
Yeah, that's
it?
Right, and that's what's so interesting. I mean, this
yeah.
is the period of the great popularity of the World's Fairs is second half of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, and what's so interesting about that from the perspective of an Americanist like
mm-hmm.
myself
yeah.
is that that's also this period of intense national consolidation
yeah.
And,
yeah.
and self-consciousness and
yeah.
change and transformation
yeah.
at home.
Yeah.
So we do move through this exhibition from the first centennial. The first major World's Fair in America was a celebration of the centennial. It was a celebration of 100 years as a nation.
Yeah,
so
that was
very
a,
much a national
project.
Yeah,
that was a Philadelphia fair where
exactly
it all started
right.
you know, 100 years earlier.
That's
also,
right. Exactly.
Way.
Exactly. So, and the site was very important
yeah.
in that sense.
Yeah.
And then we finish, obviously, at a place where the U.S. plays a very different role within, not just at home, but within a kind of world
well, just
order.
The very brink of the Second World War.
That's
then, right.
right?
Yeah. So what would motivate a city to host a fair here? I mean, is there an advantage? Because it's got to be an expensive proposition.
It is expensive.
Ways, yeah.
And one of the things that you see throughout the histories of these American fairs is that some of them are very successful and investors get their money back. But in other cases, they just don't
yeah.
because the planning was too big
yeah.
versus how much money they took in.
Yeah.
But the idea behind it was a kind of mix of civic pride and a hope for tourism of
oh,
some
yeah.
kind.
Uh-huh.
In a way that's somewhat analogous to cities competing to host the Olympics
yeah.
today,
uh-huh.
the idea was that you would bring in tons of tourists, and the really successful fairs did.
Mm-hmm.
The Chicago Fair of 1893, for example,
yeah.
had something like 27 million people come to visit.
That's like a quarter of the population
yeah,
of the United States.
Huge.
Isn't it?
It's
yeah.
kind of unfathomable.
Yeah.
I don't think we have something today, a single cultural phenomenon
yeah.
that brings that many people
yeah.
physically to one space.
Yeah, no,
one
they didn't have the internet back then.
Right,
so,
exactly.
You know, they didn't,
or movies.
Yeah, or movies,
yeah.
Or TV.
It was a nationalizing force because it was bringing people together in a way that, you know, other kinds of transportation are, like railway networks and stuff like that. It was very much a nationalizing force.
So there's certainly a certain amount of infrastructure that comes in with these
That's
fares,
right.
Right? Especially for transportation. So that would be one reason to have a fare, right?
I mean, yeah.
All this stuff lasts, but it seems to the rail systems,
Yes.
There are parts of LaGuardia that were built up for the 39 fare, I know, that are still
right.
there, you know. So
That's
some of
right.
the
and
so,
it, yeah. it's interesting to see that. I mean, if you ask this question, what remains from these fares?
Yeah, uh-huh.
It's a really interesting question. And I would say the earlier ones, in the late 19th and early 20th century ones, often the thing that remains as the art museum.
Yeah.
The museum
oh, that's
built to house yeah. the art displays.
Art, yeah. uh-huh.
That was often intentional. So a lot of these fairs are put up with the explicit intention of being torn down afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Facades are built out of plaster of Paris,
that's
actually.
Right, yeah. The most sort of dramatic example of this is the 1893 fair in Chicago,
yeah.
the so-called White City,
yeah.
which presents this vision of being this monumental, classicizing city.
Uh-huh.
It's using this Beaux-Arts architecture.
Yeah, wonderful photographs of it and renderings of what the
that's
what
right
the
and some of
the whole
that's
thing.
Right some of which we have on display. And yet, even though they appear so monumental and kind of permanent,
yeah.
they were made of essentially plaster. I mean,
yeah.
it's not actual marble, even
yeah,
though it's
yeah,
meant
yeah.
to look like marble. So there's this real contradiction there, right?
Yeah.
Between we could say the monumentality that they're attempting to achieve and the actual ephemerality
yeah, yeah.
of the
buildings. Well, it is virtual in a way.
It is.
It? Yeah.
It's absolutely
yeah,
virtual.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
that's in some ways what makes them compelling.
Uh-huh.
I think both to architects
uh-huh.
who get
oh.
a chance to kind
yeah.
of build a dream city,
yeah, uh-huh.
right? You
yeah.
kind of have full sweep to
yeah.
do this really exciting full-scale thing. And also, though, I think to visitors who I think had a sense that these were somewhat fake, but that made it easier to believe in them,
yeah,
right? As
yeah.
these kinds of dreams
oh,
or
yeah,
visions
yeah,
of the future.
Yeah, sure.
But
it seems so American, too, where the facade,
Absolutely.
The phony facade
that's
is a part
right.
of our architecture.
That's right,
you know,
exactly, exactly.
It's Venturi, you know, and
that's
sign,
right,
you know,
exactly. It's
yeah.
a foreshadowing
I
of that.
From Las Vegas.
Right. But I will say that the art museums do tend to stick around.
Yeah. So art exhibits, there were often exhibits of contemporary art for various nations. Did major American artists actually display in these?
They did, absolutely. And it's interesting, we tend to remember the amusement rides and that side of the fairs and the architecture,
yeah.
but the fine arts displays were a big part of what made the fairs interesting
oh,
to people
uh-huh.
and part of the cultural uplift message that
yeah.
some of the organizers wanted to communicate. Thomas Aikens's masterpiece, The Gross Clinic, was famously refused entry to the
uh-huh.
art display at the Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia
uh-huh.
and instead relegated to a display about hospitals and modern medicine.
Oh, interesting. This is essentially a portrait of Dr.
That's right, of Dr. Samuel Gross,
yeah.
who was a surgeon and a teacher of surgery in Philadelphia, prominent Philadelphia, and the painting is a very graphic display of a surgery that's in process,
yeah.
showing Dr. Gross holding the bloody scalpel with
yeah.
which he's just been
yeah.
probing the surgical wound
yeah.
of this patient. So that caused something of a stir, right? Other paintings by Aikens were in the art exhibition,
yeah.
but this one got moved to the
oh,
sort of surgery
yeah. Yeah.
location. It was that very graphic display made it seem too much like medicine,
yeah.
too much like
uh-huh.
science, and not so much like art. But Aikens wasn't the only important American artist to show at these fairs, and in addition to looking at important individual artists, you also get a little taste of how collection interests and how tastes were changing
uh-huh.
among the American public.
Uh-huh.
So you'll see interests in landscape painting
mm-hmm.
kind of circle around, because it
yeah.
wasn't just contemporary artists
mm-hmm.
that they were showing,
yeah.
they were also showing older American art.
Yeah.
It's sort of this real-time version of the organizers trying to create an American art history. They're kind of actively
oh,
trying
really?
To craft,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
this is what's important about American art.
And shape taste. Also,
exactly,
right?
exactly.
Yeah.
So for some, that will be the inheritors of the Hudson River School tradition
uh-huh.
and
yeah,
the landscape
yeah.
painting they're doing. For others, there's a slight move towards people who are doing more of an internationalizing
oh,
or cosmopolitan
yeah.
taste, people like William Merritt Chase
oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
and other artists.
And then, of course, the fairs I'm familiar with for my lifetime, the Montreal's Expo
mm-hmm.
67, also the New York Fair in 65, the Seattle World's Fair in
mm-hmm.
62. There are monuments left to those, too, that define the cities.
That's right.
Seattle, the Space Needle,
That's
still
right.
defines that city.
Absolutely.
And the Montreal affair also. You can't go to Montreal without feeling you're going back into the 60s in some ways, because there are, you know, relics from the fair still there out on the island.
That's
there.
Right.
And the, you know, the housing that was put up for the fair is still there.
Yes.
I forget what that big apartment complex is called.
That's so. Right. I think, especially as you move from the 19th into the 20th century
yeah.
fairs, what tends to get left from those later fairs
yeah.
are these landmarks,
yeah.
right? Right? These
yes,
kind of
yes.
defining landmarks that are meant to be seen from a distance, that
yeah.
are meant to kind of become icons
yeah,
of the
yeah,
city,
yeah.
in a way that's similar to the Eiffel Tower in
yeah,
Paris, which
yeah.
also
oh,
remains
that's true.
From
that,
a World's
that's,
Fair
oh, that's true.
In Paris.
Yeah,
yeah.
Bucky Fuller's geodesic
mm-hmm.
dome on Flushing, Queens there. So
right,
still,
right, yeah. exactly. So you have these, especially in the 20th century, what remains becomes less the sort of monumental vision of fine art
yeah.
as encased in
yeah.
an art museum
yeah. uh-huh.
and becomes instead these symbols or
yeah.
icons of the city that make uh-huh. a real visual impact.
Yeah. And then there's a commercial aspect here too, isn't there? And that,
yeah.
you know, they're a little like trade shows, aren't they? I mean,
they yes.
go for that.
And
so.
They absolutely, and they build on that tradition of
yeah,
kind of trade
that.
Shows.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. There's definitely a historical shift in the 30s where
yeah.
this commercialism, which has always been there, becomes in some way incredibly blatant and explicit
yeah. uh-huh.
and even becomes this organizing force of the exhibitions.
Uh-huh.
So we talked earlier about how these fairs are epistemological projects.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And early on, those categories are things like nation, right?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
it might
uh-huh.
be
yeah.
the function of goods,
yeah.
right?
Uh-huh.
We might have a machinery hall with
yeah.
all the machinery in
uh-huh.
one place. Those are the kind of categories that you're dealing with. But in the 30s, and really emphatically at the 1933 fair in Chicago
yeah.
and the 1939 fair in New York, the corporation becomes the major
oh.
category type.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The big pavilions, the most popular pavilions, are the ones that are Ford Motors,
yeah.
Chrysler
yeah.
Motors,
General
Fortune
Electric.
Magazine,
yeah, yeah.
General Electric,
yeah, yeah.
exactly. They become the star of the show in
yeah.
a way. And when you think about these fairs as selling something, in the 30s, what's really being sold, it's a form of marketing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially the car companies in the 30s, they're selling a vision of what they want the U.S. to look like in the coming decades,
mm-hmm.
which is everyone owns a car,
yeah, yeah,
and we
yeah.
build out a highway system
yeah,
to
yeah,
explicitly
yeah.
make that easier. You know, it's not as though actual objects are on sale.
Yeah.
It's much bigger than that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a chance for these companies and corporations to mold a consumer,
yeah.
right?
Oh,
to
yeah.
tell the consumer
yeah.
that this is what you
yeah.
want to do when you go back home.
So apart from commerce, there's a design element to all this, isn't there?
That's
because
right.
You know, you want to educate people in design,
yes.
know, in a sense, and what good design is.
That's right. That's right. And in the 1930s, you really see that. There's a wonderful object that we have in the exhibition that was a new acquisition that we just got, which is a design student's guide to the 1939
yeah, yeah.
World's Fair. And that very explicitly presents itself as a sophisticated designer's guide
oh,
to
yes.
the fair.
Uh-huh.
So rather than covering everything at the fair, it's only going to look at the choicest examples
yeah.
of exhibition design,
mm-hmm.
of display design, etc. The object itself is a really wonderful object of design. The typography is by Paul Rand.
Yeah.
And its cover has a really striking reduction or simplification of the Trilon and Perisphere,
uh-huh.
the triangular and circular shapes that were landmarks
yeah,
for the 39th
Fair. Yeah.
And on the cover of this, they're sort of reduced to this wonderful Platonic geometric
yeah,
forms.
Yeah.
What makes the guidebook especially great for Vassar is that the person who wrote the introduction to it, John McAndrew,
uh-huh.
is an architectural historian here at Vassar and actually designed the reading room.
Yeah, the art library where this thing sits.
Exactly.
Right now,
so that's
yeah,
a really nice...
Yeah.
kind of connection there.
Yeah. It was interesting. You pointed out he had the signature on the inside of the book and
yes.
In pencil, actually. It was, you know, kind of design object inside the book, his own
yes.
signature. And it was the same signature we have on a sort of relic on the wall, and that when we renovated several years ago, we found his own signature there with his phone number that he had left for the workmen. He was obviously functioning as a project manager as well as the architect. So, and it's the same. It's
Which
the
is
same,
incredible.
It's the same autograph.
Yeah, I was so stunned when you showed
no.
me that. When you showed me that, I don't think I'd seen that
no,
relic
no,
on the wall, that signature
there,
before.
Yeah,
but yeah, exactly. It matches the signature that's on the inside of this design book.
So I thought we might just go through some of the fairs one by one, starting
yeah.
with the 76 fair. This was in Philadelphia, and it took place in a big park.
Yeah, that's right. It took place in Fairmount Park, which
uh-huh.
still stands today. That's another thing that, in this case, really remains from the fair, is,
yeah.
is Fairmount Park was extensively landscaped. The chief architect of that fair, Hermann Schwarzmann, was in charge, also in a general way, of just transforming this park site into something that could host a fair. Yeah. And the 1876 fair is important not only as a kind of national project commemorating the Declaration of Independence.
And it's our first big fair.
It's our first big fair, that's right. There's one earlier in 1853 in New York, a kind of New York Crystal Palace, but it's much smaller and it's not nearly as successful. Yeah. And the fair at Philadelphia is important not just nationally in the U.S., but also for its contributions to kind of fair design more broadly. So in choosing a park site, it's moving away from the London Crystal Palace approach, which was to have a single building where all of the displays were massed together, and that let you have these broad vistas where you looked out and saw all of these different national displays. Yeah. Instead, at Philadelphia, we have multiple pavilions, multiple sites.
Yeah. Quite large, though, also.
Quite large.
Glass and steel buildings.
Absolutely. The buildings that are there are still in these kind of grand forms, and you can go inside them, and you still have some of those big expansive views that you would get in something like the Crystal Palace. But having that multi-pavilion, that multi-site layout, means that you have this emphasis on a kind of picturesque setting for the pavilions. It becomes a kind of park experience as well as
the Crystal Palace
fair.
Was in Kensington Park.
That's right.
Also on
that's
the
right.
Outside, but
that's right. Exactly. So you have sort of some of these themes already. And then also at Philadelphia, because the park site is not like that close to the city, it necessitated all of these transportation links. So you can see on one of the maps that we have displayed of the 1876 fair, the railroad depots that were specially built to bring people to the fair, right? Bring them up from the city into the fair and kind of make that circulation of visitors or pedestrians work.
So the buildings that remain today in the park, are they used as museums? Or?
There's one major building that remains, Memorial Hall, and that was the building that had been designed to host the art exhibits.
Oh, was it? Okay.
The Fine Art Palace, it was sometimes called. And today it is still a museum. It's gone through several iterations. It housed what's now the Philadelphia Museum of Art at one point.
Yeah.
Now it's a children's museum, Please Touch
I
Museum.
Yeah.
You can still go visit it. And the last time I was there, they had a diorama of the 1876 fair downstairs in the basement, which is really cool.
Yeah,
it gives you a kind of spatial sense of the whole layout.
And that's a kind of period piece itself. It's a diorama, right? It's
that's
people
right.
People used to experience things
absolutely.
Virtually.
That's right. And it was made only 5 to 10 years after the end of the fair.
Okay.
So it's closer in time than one might expect.
Yeah. So we have artifacts from that. We have a map and we have a guidebook, right?
That's right.
I think. And,
So we have just those two objects from the 1876 fair. The really cool thing about this fold-out map that I keep mentioning is it's this very large map that folds out from what's essentially a pocket guide, which is quite small, and it was sold on the fairgrounds.
So
it's not only a depiction of the fair, it very much was part of the visitor's experience of the fair. This was something you purchased on the fairgrounds to help find your way.
What you were looking for.
Yeah.
And then we have the 1893 fair, for which we have a children's guidebook, which is interesting. So there are lots of publications that these fairs put out, weren't there?
That's right.
So, I mean, apart from the guidebooks, there were other booklets,
and
in this case, it's for children. Yeah.
Yes, and some of these are official, and some of them are unofficial, right? Some of them are publishers capitalizing on the cultural phenomena of what's going on. The Century World's Fair Book for Boys and Girls is the name of this children's book for the 1893 fair. And it's wonderful because it gives you this kid's eye perspective about going to the fair and experiencing it. And in Vassar's copy, whoever owned it has actually colored in the illustrations. So there's little black and white illustrations that begin each chapter.
Yeah.
And many of them are colored in with crayon.
Some kid use it as a coloring book.
That's right. And that's actually what I love about these objects is they tell official histories. Yeah. They tell these official stories about imperialism and industry in the future. But they also are individual objects that were used by individual people.
Yeah.
And in that way, they tell these other smaller stories about use and reception.
Yeah, and you name the exhibition Surveys and Souvenirs, and sometimes
that's
these things are both surveys.
That's
and
exactly
souvenirs,
right. That's
they?
Exactly
and
right.
And a lot of souvenirs given out. The poster stamps are souvenirs.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah, so.
Exactly.
So, you know, you can go to this thing. And you want to be able to remember it when you came home, so, you know, you got, you know, postage stamps or you got the, you know, the booklet or whatever.
Exactly.
So it's a way to remind yourself, I actually went to Chicago.
That I was a part of this.
Exactly. And in those days, even by the brink of World War II, you know, 39, some incredibly small number of Americans had ever been more than 50 miles from their home.
Right.
So it was a
That's
big
right.
deal
it
to
was
get
a
on
really
a train
big
and
deal.
Go to Chicago or Philadelphia.
It was a really big deal.
Yeah.
That's right. And not only that, but once you got there, you were not just going to Philadelphia or Chicago. Chicago, you were going to all of these different nations that were represented. The fairs really become a form of tourism, right? That, you know, you can actually travel seemingly to these faraway places while remaining in the United States.
And then you could then see not only Japanese wares and art forms, but you could see Japanese people,
or
whatever, you know, any country, you know.
That's right, exactly. There was one person who describes the midway of Chicago as a jumble of foreignness. And I think that element of the exotic, of the foreign, really pulled people in.
Yeah.
These fairs seem to bring together this kaleidoscope of cultural difference.
So the White City exhibition, from the child's book, you can see there are rides. So, I mean, there's sort of things we associate with fairs and fairgrounds. So there are amusement rides.
That's right,
And there's
a
midway also, and then there will be more educational kind of rides.
That's right. And the Chicago Fair really crystallizes that tension or division between, on the one hand, entertainment, on the other hand, instruction and sort of cultural elevation. Because the White City itself is done in this classicizing Beaux-Arts style.
Yeah.
But the Midway, which is physically separate, it's at a kind of right angle to the rest of the fair. That is this place of amusement and fun.
Yeah.
And indeed, on the cover of the children's book, you can see both the administration building, which is part of the Beaux-Arts White City, part of the official fair.
Yeah.
But then you can also see right next to it a Ferris wheel.
Yeah. A big Ferris wheel, like they have it in London. You know,
that's right. And that was the Ferris wheel's debut, actually.
It was at the
1893 fair in Chicago.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So both of those things attracted people, or we could say each one attracted maybe different sets of people.
Yeah. Did you want to do both? If I was there.
Right, and I think the hope for a lot of people interested in quote-unquote elevating American culture is that this would be, however people got there, this would be a chance to expose them to high culture.
Yeah.
In terms of your insight about it being like fairs that we're familiar with, supposedly one of the founders of Steeplechase Park in Coney Island was inspired by seeing the Ferris wheel at Chicago, and that's his big aha, his big eureka moment to then go back and create one of these large amusement parks with rides, et cetera.
And then how would people be fed at one of these? Because I can imagine, you know, all these people coming, a quarter of the population in the United States, you know, to the Chicago Fair. If we discount what Nick had to say, some people probably
came twice.
More than once. So
came several times.
So, I mean, they had to be fed. So how on earth, and also there had to be laboratories, that kind of thing.
That's right.
So logistically, this is a big deal.
It's a big undertaking. And I think that's the part where that Philadelphia Fair becomes really important, because that's one of the first American fairs where they're actually thinking about, well, how are people going to get around this fair? Are they going to be too tired? We need they had a monorail, actually, at that fair, and a kind of railroad that went around.
Oh, at the Philadelphia Fair.
At the Philadelphia Fair. Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
It is.
Because that's still a feature of the Seattle thing.
That's right. I mean, the monorail is very short. It's more as a display of the technology itself than as a transit means. But there is another internal railroad within the fair that takes people around. But all of these questions, how tired your feet get, the need to eat, the need to use the bathroom. So those do become built in. And you have pavilions cropping up that cater specifically to food. And interestingly, in the 1930s, that becomes, you know, you get these actually rather interesting designs for concession stands. Becomes itself part of the appearance of the fair, the artistic look of the fair.
So we do have these poster stamps in the show, and I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about what they are and how they work.
Absolutely.
I mean, we had an exhibit on them in the past, just on poster stamps per se, but not everybody's familiar with them, and they were an incredibly important means of advertising when they were first issued, weren't they?
So, that's right, So poster stamps are essentially, well, we can think of them as small posters, miniature posters that look like postage stamps, but don't actually have the monetary value that stamps do. You can't mail a letter with them. So they're really more decorative. They're a form of souvenir. And they're interesting from a graphic design perspective because they present a real artistic challenge in this very small space of the stamp.
Yeah, they're an advertising medium.
That's
right.
A serious advertising medium. And you have to be able to craft a really compelling visual product in this 2x1 inch, or sometimes, you know, 1.5x1.5 inch medium.
So buy Buster Brown shoes, or...
That's right, exactly. And that was actually another beginning to this project. The first objects that I saw related to the fair were poster stamps, which I didn't know about until you told me that we had some in the collection, in special collections. But we do have many of those poster stamps in the exhibition. So these, in the context of the fair, would have been sometimes produced by official bodies within the fair. They might have kind of the logo of the 1933 fair on them, for example. Sometimes they get a little more specific. The one for the Buffalo Fair of 1901, the Pan American Exposition has Niagara Falls on the stamp,
that's
for example.
That's a beautiful object.
Yes, it is a beautiful object.
Yeah, it becomes a kind of logo for the fair.
Yeah, that's...
So these, in a way, can be places where there's a graphic design associated with the fair. I mean, apart from other kinds of design, there's graphic design, isn't there?
That's right, yeah.
And then you've got the Mucha stamps.
That's right, and that's one of my favorite stylistic contrasts in the exhibition, is between the Alphonse Mucha stamps that we have, and then this wonderful book from 1904 designed by Peter Behrens, the modern architect and graphic designer. The Mucha stamps are actually a loan for the exhibition that Art Groten lent to us, and they're wonderful. They have this very curvilinear sort of Art Nouveau style.
Sort of biter mirror.
Yes, right, exactly. And in fact, that style itself, the steel Mucha, was in a way disseminated through World's Fairs, at an earlier World's Fair. The Paris Exposition of 1900. You know, we've been talking about these fairs as magnets for people to come to. So all of these people come, and that sort of style, it's a big dissemination point for that style.
Well, the Spirit of Niagara is in that style, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, we have another, the Pan American Exposition, which happened in Buffalo in 1901. We have a couple of objects that show the Spirit of Niagara, which was unofficial logo of the fair. And that, of course, alludes to Niagara Falls, which had been for decades at this point, for almost a century, already a tourist destination.
Wonder of the world.
But it also alludes to the fact that more recently, Niagara Falls had become a source for generating electricity. So the Spirit of Niagara is not just this diaphanous nymph. She's also this electrical modern ether, right? This electrical current that moves through the ether. So we've got two wonderful images in different medium, one in a book and one on what we believe is a detached book cover, that both show the Spirit of Niagara rising up from the water.
I wonder, there must have been Edison displays or electrical displays at that fair.
That's right. There had been electrical displays at other fairs before this, but the fair at Buffalo in 1901 really makes electricity into the main theme of that.
They must pipe it in
from Niagara Falls, in fact. From 20 miles away at Niagara Falls. That was a big, it was kind of a celebration of alternating current in a way. So now we can actually transmit electricity across what seemed like a big distance, 25 miles. And a lot of the famous views of that fair are nighttime views because the buildings are lit up for nighttime.
And that was in 1901.
That was in 1901. And, you know, Edison, in addition to having his own kind of electrical display there, there's some Edison films of that fair. Which are interesting, that kind of take you through fairgrounds.
Yeah, so that took place in Delaware Park, which is an Olmsted project, so that was also
a big park. That's right, exactly. It's right on the, I think, western edge of Delaware Park. Exactly.
And Olmsted figures in a lot of these fairs, doesn't he?
He does, exactly. Either in that he was explicitly involved, as at the Chicago Fair of 1893, or in a broader sense of landscape design and park design being a big part of the fair. But that's right, at the Chicago Fair in 1893, what still remains from that fair is the Art Museum, which is now the Museum of Science and Industry. But what also remains is the broad strokes of that landscaping, right? So Jackson Park, the Midway itself, which is now runs through the University of Chicago campus, and then Washington Park on the other side. Those are all Olmsted designed projects, many of which are happening at the same time as the fair.
We've got a catalog of the Japanese fine arts exhibit at the Louisiana Purchase Exhibition in 1904, and that's a beautiful thing.
That is.
I mean, we've got the cover on display, but the whole thing is beautiful.
There have been displays of Japanese art and crafts and architecture at fairs since 1876, which is part of this broader interest in Japan, Japonismo, or Japanism in the U.S.
Ceramics and...
That's right. And
textiles.
And using these objects to deduce from that in the minds of, you know, Americans some kind of essence of Japan that has to do with a sense of beauty and a sense of elegance. But even though these objects and displays were really popular, before 1904, there was still an idea that Japan and the Japanese themselves were somehow, you know, quote-unquote primitive. In fact, in some ways, you could say it's connected to this fetishization of design objects, of craft objects. And it's at the 1904 fair that Japan really kind of self-consciously puts on an incredibly impressive art exhibition. Mm-hmm. And the responses to that display versus the responses to earlier displays at earlier World's Fairs of Japan is really striking.
Yeah.
There's one critic who even says that Japan has joined the group of the first nations of the world.
Interesting. Yeah.
But I think the other thing to keep in mind here is not only was it the art that was so impressive, but it was that Japan was able to put on this display at the same time that they're fighting the Russo-Japanese war.
And they won Russo-Japanese war that same year, right?
That's exactly right. This was sort of stunning to Americans who had this racist idea of Japan as being kind of primitive, and suddenly they can pull this off.
And then there are all kinds of other booklets that we have, publications, photographic albums. So,
That's right.
But this is one record of what they were about, especially in the arts. We've got a book about the landscape displays at one of the fairs.
At the 1915 fair in San Francisco, And that's wonderful. The 1915 fair in San Francisco is called the Panama Pacific International Exposition. I mentioned earlier that all of these fairs have some sort of national or imperial underlying theme. Well, here it's that the Panama Canal is now going to allow for American economic dominance throughout the Americas and across the Pacific, thus the location in San Francisco, kind of looking into the Pacific.
Yeah. Does this take place after the earthquake or before?
After, and that's also seen as this wonderful accomplishment of San Francisco, that it's able to rise up from the ashes.
Yeah, so Phoenix is Phoenix is part of the fair. I mean, it's like a symbol of the fair.
Yes, exactly. San Francisco has conquered this horror and reemerged.
Yeah.
We have a series of great objects from that fair. They're beautiful in and of themselves, and they document different parts of the fair. So we have one on the landscape architecture of the fair, the architecture and landscape gardening of the exposition, one on the art itself of the exposition, and then one on the Palace of Fine Arts, which was designed by Bernard Maybeck, the architect, and then one on the sculpture and mural decorations of the exposition, etc. These books form a coherent visual look. I mean, they have this beautiful kind of gold lettering on the front for the titles. But then inside, they have black and white photographs that are tipped in and that show you examples of the art or the gardening or the architecture. What's also interesting about those books is that in addition to being beautiful objects and kind of documenting the fair, many of them have inscriptions in them.
Yeah.
They were owned by Helen Wright, who I believe worked at the Library of Congress, but she basically was building a collection of books with author signatures in them. So we have Alexander Calder, not the modernist one.
No, but his father.
Exactly, we have his signature in one. Yeah. We have Bernard Maybeck, the architect's signature in his.
Yeah.
So those are neat because they show the personal relationships, between this collector and her reaching out to these architects and artists to sign and inscribe the copies.
Yeah, nice.
The Maybeck Pavilion is this really melancholy, fascinating sort of pavilion. It was the Fine Arts Pavilion, but it also had a kind of a circular element that was right by a lagoon that it overlooked. When you get a sense of the melancholy atmosphere of that.
The illustrations.
Yeah, in the photographs that are in that book, you really get a sense of that.
You can contrast that in another book with the White City because
that's
got that there. Yeah,
that's right, exactly. The San Francisco Fair in general really makes it makes this kind of statement. It's visually different than a lot of the preceding fairs. It's nicknamed the Jewel City because of the color in the fair. And one of the advantages to being in a warm climate is that they could have these outdoor murals. So there's actually a lot of painting and color outside on some of these buildings. Yeah. It's a particularly interesting fair in that way.
And then we have photo albums, too. We have the ethnic album.
That's right.
Which was from...
That was from the 1893 fair. So we've displayed that object in there's one wall in this case that's really about the display of otherness and kind of the display of other ethnicities and races. And we have this book open to a page depicting what they call the Congress of the Races on the Midway. But it's also, if you turn the corner and kind of move around the case, it's also right next to two photographs of the official part of the fair, the White City itself. So it also serves as this great contrast between what's happening on the Midway, which is this kind of jubilee of ethnographic difference and amusement, and then the official White City, which is this kind of more elite, high culture space.
White.
Yeah, white in more ways than one.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that. Visitors to the... This is a period after the Civil War when...
Yeah, Reconstruction is over.
Reconstruction falls apart.
Reconstruction
yeah,
is over.
Jim Crow comes in. So how were African Americans greeted at these fairs? Was there any controversy here?
That's a wonderful question. Uh-huh. And the answer is very complex and sort of depends a little bit on region, kind of north versus south.
Yeah.
But I think the Fair of 1893 in Chicago is a great example for looking at those issues.
Uh-huh.
So the Fair of 1893, as it was being put together, its emphasis was very much on white Euro-American culture, right? And when it did bring in ethnic others to the heart of it, like in their displays of Native American culture, it tended to be to offset what was seen as the progress of the white Euro-American race. So as this is being put together, there's actually very active pushback among African-Americans in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
You see this in the board of lady managers, the women who come together to build the women's building. So the Fair of 1893 did have a very important women's building in which Mary Cassatt did a mural. Uh-huh. But the women on that board of that building are all white.
Yeah.
And then when some black women try to join, they're just pushed out. And this causes a big row, and they eventually relent. But it's pretty clear that there's active exclusion going on here. And this causes a variety of responses. The two major ones are typified by Ida B. Wells, the anti-lynching activist, and Frederick Douglass. So Ida Wells publishes a pamphlet basically urging African Americans to boycott the fair because it's not going to have representation of African American culture.
Yeah.
Every time that a group gets together and makes a proposal for an exhibit and presents that to the organizers of the fair, it gets knocked down.
Yeah.
That's one prominent response. But Frederick Douglass decides he thinks that it would be good for African Americans to go to the fair and go in as many numbers as possible, right? To, in a way, take control of this fair. You know, this is, it does exist.
Well,
it is for Chicagoans. We are Chicagoans.
Besides being a Gilded Age, this is the age of progressivism, isn't it, also?
That's
so
right.
All kinds of social movements going on, all kinds of people working in social
That's
work,
absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, just in terms of where we are historically, this is just a few years before Plessy v. Ferguson, right? So we're just a few years before Separate but Equal will be enshrined as law. So it's a time of both intense hope, but also intense segregation.
Yeah. It's also interesting that Frederick Douglass, he appears here because he's everywhere. He's the whole 19th century.
He is, for me, the figure of the 19th century.
Yeah,
I think if you're going to pick one person to embody the 19th century of America, it's Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, he's always on the right side of the line, too.
So. That's right. It's part in that he lives through so many dramatic changes.
Yeah.
He makes a speech at the 1876 fair in Philadelphia, which in many ways is a much more hopeful moment. I mean, yes, we have the beginning of the wavering of, you know, the Compromise of 1876, which will undo Reconstruction in the South, but we're not quite there yet. By 1893, we're really in a different world, a much less hopeful world. And Douglass is at both of those places. Douglass himself was connected to the Haitian Pavilion, the Haiti Pavilion at the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, which really became a sort of mecca for black Americans because there wasn't really representation of black citizens in the United States. The Haitian Pavilion became a sort of stand-in for that. And we do see in some very vicious caricatures from the period, these aren't in our show, but they do exist, that make direct analogies, direct connections between African Americans and Africans, both of whom are rendered as savage or primitive. And you'll see that one concession to the demands of black Chicagoans and black Americans was to have a Negro Day or a so-called Colored People's Day at the 1893 fair. You know, Douglass encouraged people to attend because he thought this was a chance to kind of take it back. But this was lampooned in some really vicious caricatures in Puck and other of those illustrated magazines in which you have this pageantry, this dance of very racist, primitive Africans alongside these racist depictions of African Americans, and they're being shown as the same. Message being that an African American is only one step away from a primitive or savage state of nature. So that was definitely an active, ongoing. I mean, they were sites of struggle in that sense.
But in Chicago at the time, when everybody literally came over on the boat, as they used to say.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, so...
That's right.
Yeah,
I mean, and the fair did have other ethnic days, so there was a day for black Americans and for others, and, you know, maybe like a Polish day. I don't remember all of the different types, but they would do that. The other big story here of what's not depicted, of course, is labor, right?
Oh,
so this period of the 1890s is also a sort of explosive period of labor. The Pullman strike will happen, right, just shortly after the fair.
In Chicago.
Yeah, in Chicago. So it's a moment of, you know, we have the facade of the white city,
yeah.
but below the surface, there's a lot going on. And we could even see this kind of message of harmony and cohesion in the white city as an attempt to make over all of that division into something unified, right?
Yeah, sure. What it reminds me of a bit is Disney, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, let's put a smile on everything.
That's exactly right. And Disney has very close, we could say, genealogical ties to World's Fairs.
Yeah, Well, yeah, sure. The Seattle monorail was duplicated in Disneyland itself, wasn't it?
And one of the popular rides, the one that's set to It's a Small World After All, the kind of tour in the water boat, that debuted at the 1964 fair, a version of it, at the 1964 fair in New York. So it's quite close, those links. Or we could think of Epcot Center, too, and the geodesic domes. So there's a lot of connection
kind
there.
Of thing. Yeah, interesting. Also, we've got the ethnic photography book.
We do have this book. It's a book of photographs of the fair, including the Midway. And it really tries to show us the cacophony of events and commodities and especially cultures on the Midway.
Yeah.
So the page that we have open of that photo book in our show is one that's titled The Congress of Races on the Midway. And it shows a series of carte visite-sized photographs of people striking poses. And they're titled things like a Turkish couple, a dancer from Cairo. And all of these figures are quite fascinating in their expressions and their poses.
And they're in ethnic costumes.
And they're in ethnic, exactly. And in their costume, they're performing their ethnic identity within this context.
Must have been an incredible draw for people who weren't exposed necessarily to people.
It was.
Cultures,
it was really a form of virtual tourism for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And in the case of the Midway, one that was explicitly, we could say, about the commoditization of these cultures, right? It wasn't about instruction or education.
Yeah.
It was about the most exciting aspects of those. I mean, if you look at a map of the Midway, you have things like the Austrian village of Old Vienna, the German village, but you also have the Javanese village.
Yeah.
You have the Ottomans and the Wild East show, a Lapland village, etc. And in this sense, you know, quite the Midway itself, we have to remember, is very much separate physically from the rest of the fair. It sits at a right angle to it. So there is a way in which these other cultures, and it's either other cultures that are not Euro-American, or it's historical moments like Old Vienna. It's the past of certain European countries. That is very explicitly presented as not nearly as advanced as the white city.
Oh,
the white city is modernity at that moment, so kind of elevated modernity.
So even that far back in the 1890s, you have this sense of the modern.
That's right. And it doesn't look like modernism as we think of modernism today, but it's already there. It's absolutely already there. So next to that photo book of the different racial types, quote unquote, the Congress of the Races, we have a platinum print, an actual photograph by Frank Reinhart, who is a really important studio photographer and then photographer of Native Americans.
Yeah.
He brings into this exhibition this wonderful history of photography as a profession and as an amateur practice at fairs, because that was something that they really generated. Here are people you can encounter if you bring your camera to one of these fairs. It's just a huge array of sites and cultures that you couldn't have access to otherwise. The photograph that we have is called Bartel de Apache, and it was taken by Reinhardt at the Trans-Mississippi International Exposition.
That was in Omaha?
That was in Omaha.
So where Native Americans would have figured big time.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So 1898 is the first year of that fair, and it was successful enough that they held it again in 1899, which is the year that our photograph dates from.
Okay.
And the Trans-Mississippi Fair, the whole idea of it was to look at the plains and the West, everything across the Mississippi, right, the Trans-Mississippi Territory, as something that had been conquered by the United States, and to now look at these arrays of peoples that had been conquered, right?
Yeah.
Because it's in 1893 at the Chicago Fair, that's when Frederick Jackson Turner declares that the frontier is closed.
Right. Okay.
So that very influential frontier thesis is first given as a speech at a conference at the World's Fair in 1893. And we can see the Trans-Mississippi Expo as a sort of response to that. So,
are there Wild West shows at these things?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the frontier is now closed, and we're going to gather together all of the conquered peoples.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's what happens. At the Trans-Mississippi International Exposition, we have the largest Indian Congress ever gathered at one of these fairs.
Yeah.
it's a complicated situation, because on the one hand, there's something very disturbing about this sort of military display, right? Yes, these are people that have been conquered and subjugated, and now they're being brought together. And there's a kind of anthropological interest in it that's a little bit dehumanizing. But it also was a chance for many of these leaders and different tribes to meet and see one another. So it's a very complex history. Mm-hmm. The photograph really, I think, captures that balance especially well, because it's called Bartelda Apache. So we have both the man's name, Bartelda, and his tribal affiliation, Apache. And that's that dual focus on the individual and the tribe, or the individual and the type is repeated formally in the photograph. I mean, it's a photograph of a man standing in profile, almost like maximized for visibility.
You could almost cut it on a coin as profile there.
Yes, exactly. And
but it's beautiful.
And it's beautiful. And, but even with all of this typing features, right, and his long hair probably indicates the fact he makes him read as a Native American, but there's still psychological depth to the figure and a sense of interiority that I do really think gives it a sense of being an individual. So to me, that photograph sits right on the line between portrait type and portrait.
It's a real work of art, I have to say.
It is. It's stunningly beautiful.
And we have, I know, an amnesia about Native America, although at this time, in the 1890s, the fact that the country was co-inhabited with Indians, you know, for most of our history, it was still on people's minds.
It was, I think. It was.
It's not a memory anymore. Like I said, it's an amnesia.
There's a huge amnesia of it now, but that's right. In the 1890s, it was a very active and recent, the winning of the so-called Indian Wars, right? The closing of the frontier, which is dated to 1890, is a very recent phenomenon.
And is there an emblem of this, of some kind, in one of the emblems for the fairs?
That's right, which is really interesting. So as late as 1933, which is the Century of Progress Fair in Chicago, the official poster for that fair, which was designed by George B. Petty, and of which we have some poster stamp examples, as well as a brochure, that official kind of logo shows an allegorical depiction of Chicago, who's a woman in classical garb, and then behind her the face of a Native American who's sort of fading into the distance as she emerges in front of him. So even though we're at a much later moment, that figure of the Native American still stands in for something that disappears, something that's no longer there, against which progress can be posed, right? It sort of becomes the other side to the coin of progress in the minds of, you know, the Euro-Americans, the white Americans who are creating these objects.
Yeah, the national identity is being forged.
That's right, that's right. So Native Americans become a symbol both of actually America, but also a symbol of the past, symbol of something that is not technologically advanced, That is, that ties the land or the country back to something older.
So on to the modern fairs, especially I'm thinking of 33 in Chicago, the Century of Progress, World of Tomorrow in Flushing, Queens. The Century of Progress.
We have a number of objects from that one. So we have these poster stamps that I just referenced. We have a wonderful brochure from the fair itself, and we have a number of commemorative spoons loans. That Laurie Neustorfer and Nick Adams lent us. And then we also actually have a really nice guide to the exhibition that has a very modern cover. Almost looks like it's from the 1960s or something. And what's really great about the display of the 1933 material from Chicago is that you see the same motifs on different objects and different mediums. So you're looking at the poster stamps and you can see the transportation building and you can see Fort Dearborn and then you can also see those repeated on the spoons. So these images traveled. They traveled onto different kinds of merchandise.
Yeah, and this was the exhibit whose major buildings were planned by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill.
Yeah, that's right. The architecture firm that becomes Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill in many ways has its start here at the 1933 fair. Louis Skidmore manages to get himself appointed as the chief architect of the whole operation, which is really a huge coup. And it becomes even more of a coup once the bottom falls out of the economy and we hit the Depression. Because the fair, they started planning it in 1929. But pretty soon the world changes. Everyone's hungry for a job, and Skidmore sort of has his hands on the best job that you could get as an architect at this moment. He brings in Nathaniel Owings, and together they really set the visual language, the architectural language for that fair. There's many architects who design buildings. It's not just their work, but they really help define.
They were like the big planners.
That's right. They really sort of help define what that fair looks like, and in many ways, it's both a echo and a rejoinder to what happened in Chicago at the 1893 fair. fair, because that fair too set the language for modern fair design, using this Beaux-Arts classicizing language. Yes, very European. And you see that in basically all of the fairs after. Everyone is copying that look. For certain modern architects like Louis Sullivan, there was a sense that this dominant architectural style was actually a big step backwards, right? Yeah. That the Chicago Fair of 1893 set modern architecture back by a whole generation by making this classicizing Beaux-Arts style into the style for not just, you know, World's Fairs, but also civic buildings of all kinds. Yeah. So we can see the 1933 Fair at Chicago, which does this again. It does another sort of sweeping clean of the plate and establishing a new style. It's an echo of that, but it's an explicit rejoinder to that in the sense that this is going to be an emphatically modern design. It's not going to be this kind of Beaux-Arts or older ideal.
And then SOM goes on then to do great things.
Absolutely. Huge projects in Chicago and New York.
Because they not only know how to design a big program, but they know how to build a big program.
That's right. Exactly. So, exactly. They know how to execute that.
So then the 39 exhibit in Flushing, Queens, we've got interesting artifacts from this, including the tunnel book.
Yes. So we've got a number of great things from the 1939 fair. One of the most interesting ones, although it's a little bit unusual, is this tunnel book that we have from 1939. In a tunnel book, you can picture it like an accordion that you sort of open up, it's hinged at the sides, and then as you look down it, you see each page, kind of cut out parts of each page, and together they form what looks like a recession, a kind of alley or a boulevard, a promenade that you're looking down. It's kind of like a diorama that opens up into space.
So it's not meant to be read, opened up.
No, not at all. It's meant to be kind of peered into. And they're called tunnel books. Sometimes they're called peep show books because they have a little peephole at the front. And it's through that you look in and see this opened up interior. And in the version that we have, on the front cover, you have George and Martha Washington peering into that peephole.
So you got the past and the future.
That's right. And they're there kind of directly looking into the future, because the view that you see when you look into the peephole is in fact a view of the 1939 World's Fair with the Trilon and Perisphere right at the center.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful, the image of it too.
Yeah.
And then people strolling around.
Exactly.
The pools.
That's exactly right. So it's an object, as an object, it's very much a 19th century object. It's sort of in this category of visual and optical toys and the tunnel book itself. So that too makes it really interesting, because it's combining this nostalgia for the past in its somewhat anachronistic format and in George and Martha Washington. But then it's adding to that this really explicit vision of the future. Of the future. We have it in its original covering that it came with, which is neat.
Yeah, it is nice. So, I'm thinking, you know, if people are interested in reading about World's Fairs, Devil in the White City comes to mind, which
that's
is a very
right.
good book about the...
That's a really fun book.
It's at the 1893 fair in Chicago, the White City exhibit. But there are other books also.
There are other books. I mean, I think the main books that we worked with in the class that I taught, one is a book called Envisioning the Nation by Astrid Boger. Robert Rydell has also written a lot of books on fairs in America, including a very accessible one called Fair America. Uh-huh. But in addition to that, I think the really fun places to go for this are in fictional accounts.
Yeah.
So E.L. Doctorow's very famous World Fair book, for example, from the 1980s, or in The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Michael Chabon has a whole chapter that's sort of devoted to the spaces of the 39 Fair. Uh-huh. There's also, of course, movies, the most famous of which is probably Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yeah, with Judy Garland, beautiful.
With Judy Garland, that really helped to set the cultural memory of these fairs.
Only she only gets to the fair at the end.
That's right, exactly.
But even so, you know, it's
that's
nice,
right.
You know.
The last thing I'll say too is that we talked about the fine art exhibits, which were really important, but it's also important to emphasize how much the fairs were instrumental in helping to create and shape a rising mass culture in the United States and really in the world.
Yeah.
And this is true because it's drawing so many people together into one space.
Yeah.
And the kinds of objects that are produced from this, guidebooks, children's books, souvenirs, all of these mass-produced objects that are about vision and seeing and remembering the fair, but are also helping to spread certain kinds of styles and certain kinds of visual habits, certain kinds of ways of engaging with
the
world.
Well, you can see that the Baron's book.
Absolutely.
It's a pure modernism, and you can see he's pushing out the Biedermeier just below at the Mocha.
That's exactly right.
So are we going to see any more fairs? There is a committee in Paris that decides who gets to have a
That's
World
right.
of Boats Fair when, and it's still ongoing, but we haven't had one since Expo in 67.
Right,
and
here.
That was Canada, and then the United
That's
States,
right.
I think, was the New York Fair before that. So do you have any hopes of ever going to a World's
You know,
Fair?
I don't think so. I mean, so they do still exist. They do still happen. They don't really happen here in the United States or even in Canada, and I think that the main reason is that we have other cultural forms that are filling the needs
yeah.
that fairs used to fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we still have many elements of fairs,
yeah.
but they're not all brought together in
one
thing,
place.
Right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we've got the Olympics, which are a form of international
yeah,
competition.
Yeah, the states all have their state fairs.
The states have
there.
State
yeah,
fairs.
Those are agricultural displays.
Exactly.
Yeah, so.
We've got amusement parks. We
yeah.
have all of these elements, but they're disaggregated.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that notion of a universal world, an encyclopedia where you could have it all together has lost appeal
yeah,
for
yeah.
us.
Although you can imagine, there is an emphasis on globalization these days. So
Certainly.
You can imagine creative people really redoing the ethnic parts of the fairs and also technology.
From a critical
you know,
perspective,
you,
that's right.
Elon
yeah.
Musk would have to be there.
That's
you
right.
Know, showing
that's
up
right.
what he's doing.
That's
same,
right, exactly.
Same Edison was in, you know, in Buffalo.
That's exactly
thing,
right.
So that,
that's right. And I think that's actually what you're saying about globalization and global cultural networks today is part of what makes the exhibition and the course that I taught interesting to
uh-huh,
us today.
Oh,
because
yeah.
these are at an earlier moment
yeah,
in
uh-huh.
that globalizing story.
Yeah.
But because of its distance from us, we can perhaps more clearly see
oh, yes,
how those
yeah.
different elements
yeah.
are being brought together.
Yeah.
And there are people who have done critical rereadings of the fairs in literature. One
uh-huh.
in particular, Alfred Usson, is an author who wrote a book called Voyeurs and Savages, which is
uh-huh.
basically a rewriting of the 1904 fair in St. Louis
uh-huh.
from the perspective of the Filipino people
uh-huh.
who were basically put on display
yeah, yeah.
at that
and
fair.
And had just been conquered, right?
That's
so,
exactly
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
the 1904 fair is not the first fair after America has conquered its Pacific Empire, but
yeah.
it's one of the early ones.
Yeah.
So the Philippines is now a possession of the United
yeah,
States.
Yeah.
So there are these more recent attempts to critically interrogate
yeah.
what happened at those fairs
yeah.
and to retell them from
yeah.
another side,
yeah.
another perspective.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank you, Emily, for allowing me to sit in your office and talk to you about your exhibit, Surveys and Souvenirs, American World's Fairs, 1876 to 1939, on view in the Art Library until May 29th.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it has.